rather than going into this and saying this is an iterative process where every time I do something, my primary metric is growth and learning. Most people go into it and their primary metric is this must succeed. And then when it doesn't succeed, because it you know, very often it doesn't, you know, by their terms of I've created something beautiful. Like the dream outcome that I had is the outcome that I actually experienced. And when it doesn't hit that, then people look at the entire investment as a failure. And they get dejected because they're like, well, why would I do that again? Because I'm just going to end up banging my head against the wall again. I'm going to go do something else. Rather than looking at it and saying, you know what? I'm in this because something deeper inside of me is calling to be in this. And I have a sense for what I want to be capable of creating. And I'm open to the possibility that this will very likely take me years, if not decades. You know, it's a classic Ira Glass quote, right? Yeah. You develop that sense of taste long before you develop the capability to produce on the level that of that taste.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. If you haven't checked it out yet, our Sunday Quiver is like a behind-the-scenes DVD for the themes of the week's interviews. We recommend articles, links to books written by our guests, TED Talks, and a whole bunch of other stuff. And once a month, we compile a reading list of all our favorite books. In addition to that, you'll get resources and references from the show, so that way you don't have to go chasing them down. Just visit unmistakablecreative.com/newsletter to sign up and learn more. Today's episode of the podcast is sponsored by HostGator. So we're getting close to the end of the year. In fact, we're probably more than 3 months away from the end of the year. And so maybe you're thinking about projects that you are considering starting or had thought about at the beginning of the year, and now is a perfect time to potentially start those things. And I always say one of the easiest first steps for any creative project is to build a website. And fortunately, our friends at HostGator can help you get started because they're providing 30% off all of their hosting packages for Unmistakable Creative listeners. They have 24/7 live support via phone, chat, and email, and an easy-to-use website builder if you're not tech-savvy. So visit hostgator.com/creative and use the promo code creative at checkout for 30% off. Jonathan, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Awesome to be hanging out with you.
Yeah, it is really, really cool to have you back here. You know, it's interesting because you and I go way back. It's funny because you're probably one of a handful of people who has made multiple appearances on our show, both when we were Blogcast FM and as Unmistakable Creative. And I know that you have a new book coming out, and definitely we're going to spend a lot of time talking about it. But before we get there, I want to ask a question that was actually prompted by the very beginning of the book. You know, you open the book by talking about your relationship with your mother and the fact that your father left. And I'm curious about the impact that the relationship you have with your mother has had on your life and your work.
And also like the... You know, so I open it basically telling a story that, you know, a lot of kids have gone through. You know, their parents end up splitting, and you know, they actually did it as amicably and respectfully as they could. But you know, I was and I think a lot of kids in sort of like that generation and my generation, you know, you end up spending most of your time with your mom, and it was an interesting dance, you know, like kind of learning how to explore that dynamic together, and like just the two of us living alone in a house. And I wasn't home for a lot of time after that. This was towards the latter part of high school, so you know, I still had a bit of time in there, but you know, it was interesting. It was also really, it was an interesting moment for me because everything kind of became uncertain, and for the first time, you know, you see and you sense vulnerability in a parent that you don't ever, as a general, well, maybe I shouldn't generalize, but I didn't really ever see before that time. Maybe I just didn't want to see it. I don't know. So it kind of, you know, it pushes you and it really, it makes you question a lot of things, but probably in a good way, at least for me.
On the uncertainty piece, I mean, I know this was really the subject of your last book, and it's funny because it seems like the seed for that idea got planted very early in your life. I'm just wondering, you know, navigating that kind of uncertainty at such a young age, I mean, what did you learn about navigating uncertainty then that applied later on in your life?
Yeah, can always count on you to ask me questions that I don't see coming.
Yeah, obviously. You should know that by now.
Of course. No. You know, it's interesting. If I reflect on that time, I don't know if... I think probably a bunch of what it taught me was self-reliance. And also what I'd seen, not just in that moment in time, but also growing up, you know, is that I grew up and my mom was an artist and a craftsperson. And so she lived in that space of constant creativity and uncertainty. And I think seeing that and seeing her keep going back to that place and seeing both sides of the creative spectrum in that, you know, you never knew if she was a potter for most of my younger years, and she could spend hours and hours and hours making something on a wheel and then have a kiln load full of stuff, and then she had this massive gas-fired kiln that you could literally walk into, and you know, it would take, you know, like a full day to fire this thing, and you go through this entire process. And the whole thing is done very unscientifically. You have these little cones that are designed with different substances that melt at different heats over time. And you would just sort of like pull a brick out of the kiln and peer in with, you know, welder's goggles to see how many of the cones were melted to try and get a feel for how hot it was and how long it was going. And you go through this incredible, long, arduous process. And then you'd let the thing cool down for a couple of days and peel the bricks out brick by brick. And you didn't know if you were going to have something gorgeous, or you didn't know if everything inside would have exploded or melted down, or you just have some sort of, you know, like chemical disaster until you actually did that. And so I think it was really interesting, probably a lot more informative to sort of my lens on uncertainty in the creative process, seeing my mom navigate being a craftsperson and devoting all of her energy to making something, knowing that part of her process was at the end, there was this really big thing that had to happen, and it could manifest in really creating something beautiful or completely tearing apart all the work you had put into it. And that was just a part of the process for her. You know, that was an unknown part of the process, and it was just something that you kind of like leaned into. You know, it's funny, like thinking back, that those are the stories that really stay with me, and seeing her not get freaked out. You know, obviously if she pulled this thing open after so much work and bad stuff had happened, you know, she was not a happy person. But at the same time, the next day she went back in the studio because that's what you do.
So two questions. What do you think prevents people from being able to go back the next day? Like, what is it that inhibits grit based on, you know, sort of the experiences that you've had and the stories that you've been able to tell? Because I know you've talked to some really just fascinating people in your life.
Yeah, I think there are a couple things. One is the expectation of success. The expectation that rather than going into this and saying this is an iterative process where every time I do something, my primary metric is growth and learning. Most people go into it and their primary metric is this must succeed. And then when it doesn't succeed, because it you know, very often it doesn't, you know, by their terms of I've created something beautiful, like the dream outcome that I had is the outcome that I actually experienced. And when it doesn't hit that, then people look at the entire investment as a failure. And they get dejected because they're like, well, why would I do that again? Because I'm just going to end up banging my head against the wall again. I'm going to go do something else. Rather than looking at it and saying, you know what? I'm in this because something deeper inside of me is calling to be in this. And I have a sense for what I want to be capable of creating. And I'm open to the possibility that this will very likely take me years, if not decades. You know, it's a classic Ira Glass quote, right? Yeah. You develop that sense of taste long before you develop the capability to produce on the level of that taste, you know. And most people don't want to wait. They want to get there now. And I get it because that's me too. Mm-hmm. My sense is that the people who develop, you know, that sense of grit that allows them to endure through so many trials, to get to that place where capability equals taste and sensibility, and where the thing that you see in your mind that you want to create is actually the thing that you become capable of creating. It's approaching the process as with an understanding that this is going to take time. And each time I do something, all I'm really doing is running an experiment. And the primary thing that I want to get out of it is I want to learn. And if I can create beauty along the way, well, that's awesome. It's a really nice bonus. My ultimate goal is to create beauty. But I know along the way, I'm going to have to create a ton of ugly stuff to get there. And that's okay. So I think if you go into it with that lens, you're able to endure the process with so much more grace.
Yeah. It's kind of fitting to talk about this since we were just talking about book sales.
Yeah.
Same thing. It's a lesson. It's so weird because to me, it's one of those things I was like, wow, I wrote about this very thing in my book, and yet I have to remind myself of this on a daily basis.
Yeah, dude, we all do. I mean, yeah, I'm on my third book now and creating stuff since I was a kid. You know, I've been painting since I was a kid, creating businesses since I was a kid. And the reason I wrote my last book before this was because even through decades of doing all this work, I was still bleeding every time I did it. You know, and I just want to figure out, like, is there some way to be just at least baseline okay? And, you know, to sort of like create a different lens on the process that'll just be more forgiving. Because I think most of us are not wired to look at any sort of, you know, large scale, long term creative endeavor that way. And my sense is that the way technology is going, it's training us to have the expectation of instant across all domains. And there are just certain things that you can't rush. There's, you know, things that require a rewiring of your neural circuitry that there is nothing that you can do. There's no technology in existence. There is no deliberate practice that will make that happen faster. Mm-hmm. It your brain takes time to get there.
Yeah. Yeah. Tell me about the relationship with your father. And more importantly, I mean, having had a father leave when you were young, how has that changed your approach to parenting, or what impact has that had on your approach as a parent?
Yeah, you know, so it's interesting. So my parents split, but my dad didn't leave my life. You know, he was still very involved and still is to this day. So I didn't experience it so much as my dad leaving. Mm-hmm. I experienced it as my parents splitting. And my folks were and still are very different. My mom has always been much more on sort of the crass person side. And my dad, until very recently, my dad was a guy who had one job for his entire adult life. And he literally just retired a couple of years ago. And he retired largely just because he didn't want to have to deal with academia. But he's still, he's a researcher. He researches human cognition, the human learning process. And he's done that. He did it in an academic environment as a professor and running a lab for, I want to say, 50 years. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's gotten to a point where he retired and but he's still doing all of his work and doing all of his research just in sort of, you know, like collaborations with other people that he knows in academia that have labs. So he doesn't have to sort of deal with the world of academia and sort of the bureaucracy and stuff like that. So he didn't leave my life. He was still in my life and continues to be. And, you know, it's been interesting to see him be that example of somebody who found something that he was absolutely consumed by at a very young age and stayed with it and developed a level of mastery and, you know, grew a lab that generated a stunning amount of research and publication. And he spent a lot of time traveling around the world, speaking about the work in the lab and publishing. It's contrary to the way that so many people think about building a career these days, mm-hmm. where you think about jumping from thing to thing to thing to thing to thing, yeah. and constantly balancing multiple different pursuits. So it's really interesting to see an example of somebody who literally put all of his marbles in one basket for his entire life and developed a level of deep mastery around it. So I think it's good to see examples of that because there are very few these days.
It's interesting when you describe both your parents to me, your work makes so much more sense to me now because
I'm definitely a blend of both.
Yeah, you really are. I mean, because part of what I've always appreciated about your work is that there's this very inspirational element to it. And yet it's always backed up by a lot of practicality as well. And that's why I think what you do is so interesting, and I find it so valuable. And like I said, I mean, hearing you describe both your parents, it makes complete sense. You know, one of the things that I thought was interesting was when you're talking about your dad, you talked about him becoming consumed by this one thing. And, you know, I look at growing up, I look at school, I look at education, and I'm not a parent, so I am always curious when I talk to parents, what is it that, you know, how do you identify those moments when you are completely consumed by something that could actually lead to something great?
Yeah, such a good question. I'm 50 years old and I'm still looking for those moments in myself. And as a father to now a teenager, you know, like a daughter who's in high school, I'm sort of on the lookout for those moments with her, because I know that one of the most incredible gifts that you can find for yourself is to find those things that absolutely light you up. And, you know, and lean into them and really invest increasing amounts of energy in those things. And I don't think there's any formula. I don't believe that there's, here's what I've seen. There are some people that hit the planet and they turn 5 years old and something, they just know. They know. There's a knowing that this is what they want to do. I mean, I had a chance to sit down with Milton Glaser, you know, who's the most iconic living designer in the world right now. And at 6 years old, he knew what he wanted to do with his life. He didn't necessarily know that would lead to being a designer and a teacher, but he knew that he wanted to draw and make art and make beauty. And he followed that path and has never wavered from it for 70 years now. Still astonishingly prolific in what he does. You know, but a lot of people look at that and they say, well, that's what I want to do, and not realizing that that is very much the outlier. And for most of us, you know, I think the process is much more about staying open, and it's funny because this reflects back on what we were just talking about the creative process. Mm-hmm. It's about looking, it's about first exalting, understanding that finding the things that genuinely light you up, that spark you, are critically important. They really help in your quest to live well and contribute meaningfully to the world and to your life. And saying, okay, this may take me years, it may take me decades, but part of my job is to just continue to try things, to run those series of deliberate experiments. Again, not saying this must succeed, but saying, huh, what can I learn about myself by doing this? And doing it until you get answers. You know, I think one of the biggest tragedies that tends to happen now is that so many people graduate from school, from secondary education, with such a mountain of debt that it almost forces you to lock yourself into a career path that services your debt rather than allows you to run those experiments. And very often it takes decades before you can extract yourself. And at that point, people start to run those experiments, or they just kind of become so dejected and feel like, well, my path is what it is, that they serve out the rest of their time doing what they've started doing and built a career and a life around doing. And I think that can be, some people can be okay with that, but I think for a lot of people, it can also be relatively tragic.
It's really interesting you say that, because I mean, I have my student loan debt, and I think my sort of take on it was that I vowed not to live my life in service of paying off that debt, because I knew it would lead to exactly what you're talking about. And I thought, you know, if I get to the end of my life and all I've accomplished is paying off debt, like if that's what somebody had to write on my tombstone, he paid off his student loan debt, I thought, you know what? There's no way I'm going to go out like that.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I think you're the exception. Well, you know that, you know that already. Yeah. So,
you know, I have to ask, as a parent who has been exposed to all of these ideas and all of these people who've made these very unique sort of career paths for themselves, how do you think about education for your own kids?
Yeah. So my daughter's in private school, and it's more of a progressive education approach. But there's still a certain amount of mainstream that has to happen, especially when you're in high school. And, you know, at the end of the day, everybody sort of is moving towards the same tests and the same potential, you know, like quest to go to college. But I've actually sat down and I've told her, I've said, hey, listen, if you feel like college is the right thing for you, you know, let's have a conversation about it, and I'll support you in that decision. But I don't have any expectation that like that is the absolute mandatory next step for you, because for a lot of people, it's not the most sensible thing. You know, when I went to school, it was pretty dirt cheap. you know, there was a really high expectation that if you wanted a job after that, paying a decent amount of money, you would get it, and you would repay your loans, you know, relatively quickly. Pretty much everybody, you know, got through that process and moved on. And the financial equation is profoundly different these days. And the need to actually have a degree to do so many different things is also dramatically lessened. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like an ongoing conversation. You know, I think a gap year spent well can be really, really powerful. Yeah. Thing. So, you know, I guess my approach with my wife is, you know, we're kind of holding different doors open and saying, listen, we don't have any expectation that, you know, there's one next step and that's what you have to do. You know, we're open, and we've kind of invited her to be open to exploring different options and seeing what feels right. And I've even at one point, I was like, look, if you want to start a business, you know, rather than go to school or put off school for a bit and try and build something, I'll help you do it. So that's been my approach.
Interesting. Just out of curiosity, does she read your books or listen to Good Life Project?
She does not. although, interestingly, some of her friends do.
Wow.
If there's something really interesting, she will.
Yeah.
But not on a regular basis.
Yeah, it's interesting because my parents don't listen to the show, or you know, I think the most recent book is the only one that they've actually read, which is, yeah, I was just really curious. This episode of the podcast is sponsored by DesignCrowd. So maybe you find the whole idea of designing things really intimidating, or it seems really out of reach or really expensive. Well, it doesn't have to be, because that's where a service like DesignCrowd comes in. They make the equivalent of an entire creative team accessible to you at a price that's affordable to anyone. And here's how it works. You go to designcrowd.com and you submit your design brief for whatever your project might be, whether it's a logo, whether it's a flyer, whether it's an ebook, whether it's a website. Then you'll get submissions from anywhere between 60 to 100 designers from around the world. If you like what you get, you can then improve payment. If you don't like what you get, you can go back to the crowd and ask for more, or you can ask for your money back. And because you're an unmistakable creative listener, you're getting $100 off of your first design project. So visit designcrowd.com/creative, where you'll not only be able to see some of the sample projects that other unmistakable creative listeners have had designed, including logos, business cards, and all sorts of other stuff, and you'll get $100 off your first project. So that's designcrowd.com/creative, and use the promo code creative for $100 off of your first design project. This episode is also sponsored by our friends at HostGator. So let's say that you have gotten yourself a beautiful website designed from DesignCrowd, but now you need a place to host that website. Well, that's where HostGator comes in. They have 24/7 live support via phone, chat, and email. They're incredibly reliable. And not only that, because you're an unmistakable creative listener, you're getting 30% off all of their hosting packages. So visit hostgator.com/creative and use the promo code creative at checkout for 30% off. Well, let's do this. Let's shift gears. I want to start getting into the ideas in the book, but I want to start by asking you, I mean, what in the world made you decide that this is the question that you want to answer, how to live a good life? Because, you know, that the answer to that question could be the quest of a lifetime.
Yeah, and it is, and it has been. Yeah. So it was less me deciding this is the question that I want to answer. It was more of me deciding that I'd reached a point where I thought I had something to say that might matter. Mm-hmm. And because this is a question that I've been living for my entire adult life, you know, from pretty much as far back as I can remember. I've always been deeply fascinated by both the human condition and the exploration of human potential. And that's manifested in a lot of different ways. It's manifested in art. It's manifested in businesses. But there's a really interesting through line, which is that everything has always been connected by this bigger question of how can we create things that allow people to live better, to live more meaningful, engaged, connected lives in the world. But it takes, you know, Steve Jobs' classic quote, right? You know, you need enough dots to be able to look back and start to see how they connect. And I think reached a point in my life now where, you know, hopefully, you know, God willing, I'll have a lot more dots to create and gather and reflect on. But there are enough now so I can start to see patterns in my own life, patterns in the lives of the so many people I've been fortunate to spend time with, and feel like there was a way that I could potentially share what I've been seeing that might resonate with people, and help them engage with the world a bit differently and feel better and feel like they're getting more of what they came to get. And it was interesting. I think I've told you this backstory. I can't remember, but this is actually not the book that was sold to my publisher. The book that was sold was A Deep Dive into Belonging. And over time, a bunch of stuff happened and we shifted gears. And this was the book that ended up coming out of a very long and arduous process.
Hmm. So how is your perspective on what it means to live a good life changed both through the multiple iterations of the careers that you've had as well as with age?
Well, beyond getting more jaded, not just kidding. I think that's just a factor of living in New York City. There's, you know, I make decisions differently. Different things matter to me. My sense of what's possible has shifted. So, for example, at an earlier point in my life, I'm still pretty risk tolerant for somebody who's sort of at the point in my life where I am. When I look at a lot of my friends, they're probably a lot less quick to try new things. That said, I'm almost definitely nowhere near as risk tolerant or even risk inviting as I was in my 20s and even early 30s because, frankly, I have more to lose now.
Yeah,
you know. And I think we all get that way, where I still want to grow and I still want to go into that place of uncertainty because that's where possibility lies. But at the same time, I'm acutely aware of the fact that I like my life right now, and I've got a beautiful family and deep relationships with them, and the ability to be present and to create and contribute in ways that I really like. And before I'm willing to just blow it up, or, you know, the classic quote, go to zero, I'm going to think long and hard about doing that, about what I say yes and no to on a level that I probably wouldn't have weighed in anywhere near the sort of like the depth a decade or two earlier in my life. And also at the same time, you know, I have a family, and as much as I know security is largely an illusion, you know, to the extent that I can feel that sense and also create that sense for them, mm-hmm. I feel like as a parent, that's part of what I'm here to do. Part of it is also, you know, like teach my kid that, you know, it's good to step into the abyss. At the same time, I want her to feel okay in the world for this moment. I know there will be times, you know, down the road where I won't be able to play that role as much. So as long as I'm here and able to do that, I want to. The other side is that, like you said, I'm this really kind of total amalgam of both parents. Like my dad's sort of quantitative space, like fact validated, and my mom's, you know, complete sort of craft, spiritual, ultra creative side. And what I've seen is that I started out probably much more heavily towards the, you know, if you want me to believe it, you need to prove it to me side. And I still look for scientific validation for anything. If there's science behind something, I'll default to that. But I've become much more open over the years to the possibility that if a phenomenon happens and there's no science to it, there's no way that I can validate it through rules of science, or that it's still legitimate. And maybe there's just something that's unexplainable. Maybe there's a spiritual component to it. Maybe there's something that it is beyond, you know, rational description, but that doesn't invalidate the fact that this thing happens and this thing exists. And rather than sort of like having to find the scientific validation or else refute the fact that it's possible, I've gotten much more comfortable with the idea that, yeah, there's just stuff that happens that I've seen happen so many times that I have no way to provide a rational basis for, but it is.
you know, it's interesting to hear you talk about risk and how, you know, you get to the point where you have more and more to lose, because I even feel that way now, even though I don't have, you know, family or kids. But as we've grown, you know, this business into what it is, and a team around us and editors and agents and all these people, I'm like, wow, there's a lot of people who count on me to make sure that I don't go off the deep end.
Yeah. I mean, it's the same thing here too. When you're building a business, you know, and you've got people, it's you make decisions, or at least I make decisions differently. And maybe that makes me not a classic entrepreneur, but, you know, I think that's just the way that, that I've changed and evolved. And I'm pretty okay with that, actually.
Well, let's do this. I want to start getting into sort of the three core ideas in the book that really, I think, you know, we talked a little bit about it last time you were here, but I want to do a sort of another deep dive into this, because some of this is so fascinating. So could you give us sort of an overview of the three buckets, what they consist of, and how they are all interrelated to each other?
Yeah, sure. So the idea is really simple. And the underlying idea was to create a model for crafting a good life that you would hear once, remember for life, and that could guide your behavior. So over time, this developed into this thing I call the three buckets. So it's really simple, that your life is made up of three buckets, and I call them vitality, connection, and contribution. Your job in the quest to live a good life is to fill those three buckets and to keep them as full as possible for as long as possible. So on a really sort of macro level, you know, to fill your vitality bucket, we're talking about optimizing your state of mind, your state of body. On a macro level, for your connection bucket, we're talking about building deep and meaningful relationships, and on multiple levels, on the most intimate level, all the way through a communal level, and on a broad, indefinable level with God or source, if that's something that matters to you. And then on the contribution bucket, that's really about bringing your gifts to the world in a way that is profoundly aligned with the essence of who you are, and that creates the experience of deep meaning and alignment and a sense of being fully utilized, you know, by the work that you're doing in the world. And that doesn't necessarily equate to your job, by the way. That work may be something that lies outside of the thing that you get paid to do. So that's your... But the basic model is, it's really that simple. It's, if you spend a little bit of time every day doing something to top off those buckets, then, and you turn it into a practice, you make it less about being a goal, but just knowing, this is my practice and this is my practice for life. This never stops. Mm-hmm. And my daily practice is to sense what needs filling and do a little something that day to fill it. Then over time, in without massive disruption or change or radical uprooting, over time, there are all these small shifts that start to happen, and you start to realize, wow, things are better. Mm-hmm. I'm feeling better. I'm feeling more, you know, like there's more of a purpose. There are deeper relationships. My health and vitality and state of mind are just slowly getting better. You know, it's like for you, you know, it's so interesting, because if you look at you and sort of what you've been through over the last few years, really having to pull yourself out of a really dark place, you know, there's this one thing that you turned to that became a powerful bucket filler. That was surfing, you know, and that, you know, it was this thing that you do every day, partly because you love doing it. But also, if you deconstruct it, well, what's that actually doing? You know, it's your, it's amazing exercise. So on, you know, on multiple levels, it's really focusing on improving your health through moving your body, through mobilization and movement. It's also deeply meditative and attention training. So it really, it's a powerful thing for your mindset. Also just being out in the water, in the waves, you know, is something that can drop you into a state where it's sort of like nothing else matters when you're in that place. It's like you're completely and utterly present. And at the same time, it's communal, you know, it's relational. So it's doing something to also fill that connection bucket, because as a general, I mean, I know plenty of people surf alone, but you know, as a general, and this is from your conversation that we've shared, you know, you have friends that you go surfing with, and even if you don't go with them, you've got all the regulars that are there, and it's this thing where you're participating. You have a sense of belonging in a community of people who are committed to this beautiful thing, and that, you know, amazingly turns around and unlocks your ability to then lean into the work part. You know, all this stuff that gets sort of cranked down and you can't figure out how to really access and tap that potential on your creative and your work side, your contribution side, you know, filling those other two buckets is the thing that eventually unlocks that. So it's kind of fun to look at your process over the last few years and see how you can take almost anybody and really quickly understand how these things work by just this really simple model of the buckets.
Yeah. How do you know when the right bucket isn't full? Like what kind of signals do you see in your life, or how do you develop the awareness that a bucket is either getting to a point of being too low or that it needs to be filled?
Yeah. I mean, so there are kind of two answers. There's the quick intuitive hit, you know, it's the thinking slow and the thinking fast systems. Right. I think we all know deep down, mm-hmm. like you wake up in the morning, you're like, my relationships suck. I haven't talked to my best friend in like 3 weeks. You know, like my parents have been estranged, whatever it may be. Or you wake up and you're like, you know what, I'm achy, I'm tired, I never feel like I have energy. We can get pretty delusional because we don't actually want to own it, but we all pretty much know. You know, so there's a quick intuitive hit that you can do. And we actually, it's funny, I don't think I even told you this, that we created our own companion practice journal for this book that's coming out at pretty much the same time. So part of the daily morning practice is to do what I call a really quick bucket check, literally take 10 seconds and draw a line that represents the level of each bucket just completely intuitively. Mm. And we pretty much know. But then you can also go deeper and you can ask specific questions, and they're generally preceded by how satisfied am I with? And then you ask that about the various types of elements that might fill each bucket. And in relatively short order, you can figure out what's in need of a little bit of love.
Yeah. It's interesting because I very rarely, once in a blue moon, will take a laptop to the bedroom because I'm too tired to sit in front of a TV and I just want to watch a movie. And I'm like, every time I do that, I wake up the next morning and I'm thinking, why did I do that? I didn't sleep anywhere as near as well as I know I would have if I hadn't done that.
I know, me too. I'm like, if I know that if I'm on a screen after a certain time of night, I'm almost guaranteed to wake up in the middle of the night with a headache.
Yeah, yeah, I noticed, and it's funny because I think that when you're in a deeply creative phase or working on a big creative project, this is something I was thinking about this morning as I was kind of journaling, and I thought, you know, when I'm preparing to write a book, I'm like an athlete training for a sporting event or a boxer training for a fight. And I thought, okay, reduce it to one glass of wine instead of two, because I saw between two glasses of wine and a laptop in bed, I didn't wake up in the best state of mind.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's funny because you become hyper aware of those things, I think, when you're deeply immersed in some sort of creative project.
Yeah, I think that's true. But I think at the same time, though, the exact opposite can tend to happen, which is that you completely lose track of everything else that matters.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, you talked about the daily practice through the lens of my life. I'm curious what it looks like through the lens of yours.
Yeah, so what my daily practice is?
Yeah.
So a couple of things. And for me, because I'm like the experimenter, and I think part of my responsibility is to constantly test stuff. And share what I learned. You know, I'm changing things up on a regular basis, but there are a few things that are bedrock for me. And one of them has been a really longstanding practice, and I know you have a practice too, which is my mindfulness practice. Mm-hmm. And that's something that it's the first thing I do. I wake up in the morning, and I've actually, my morning practice starts the evening before with setting up my coffee machine, so that all I have to do is hit my burr grinder first thing in the morning, put the grinds in, hit go, and then the coffee starts brewing, and then I go and I sit and I meditate for about 25 to 30 minutes every morning. Mm. And I actually start out with a few minutes of breathing exercises, sort of yogic breathing exercises before I do that, and then I drop into my meditation. And then from there, I experiment with different things. I'll sometimes do that quick bucket check too and just say, okay, what needs a bit of love today? Like where do I need to focus my action? I'll try and get a beat on what is the most important thing I can do today, and commit to that, and everything else becomes gravy. One thing that I'll try and do is just get a really, really quick win under my belt. And that may literally be sending a note or a text or an email to somebody saying, hey, I just want to let you know, that thing that you did or you said to me last week or 3 weeks ago. I've really been thinking about it, and it made a difference to me. So I want to thank you for it, and thank you for you know, being in my life. You know, just something literally that takes 30 seconds, but it's this quick little bucket win. And then I move into my day. And then for me, the earlier parts of my day, I try and make all about creation, because I find that that's where my brain is best optimized to do the work, either really early or really late. But really late doesn't work all the way well for my lifestyle.
Yeah.
And then in the later parts of the day or the afternoons, I generally leave for a conversation and for other work and for sort of interaction, stuff like that. And then there's movement too, which is which I kind of try and sneak in it in the margins, and I keep trying different ways to exercise and move my body as well.
Yeah. You know, one thing I realized I don't think I've ever asked you, and maybe I did and don't remember, is throughout all this, have there been any sort of rock bottom, like very sort of dark night of the soul moments in your life?
I mean, yeah, I think, you know, nobody hits their middle years without something.
Yeah.
For me, and yeah, I think we've talked about this, but probably not in the context of sort of like being a rock bottom moment. But I was in 2010, I ended up diagnosed with tinnitus or tinnitus, depending on how your healthcare professional pronounces it, which started like I know the exact date and the exact time because it was that profound in my life. And for those who don't know what that is, I mean, there's guaranteed something like 10 to 15% of your listeners have it on some level. But for those who don't know, it's essentially the way it manifested with me. What tinnitus is, it's a catch-all phrase, which means that you hear stuff that nobody else hears. And the reason is because it's actually being generated sometimes originally by your ears, but then eventually by the auditory centers in your brain. And that can be any variety of sensations or sounds, but for most people it manifests in this really high-pitched, loud, sound that reverberates through your head 24/7. Most people who get it, it ends up going away. It sometimes is a factor of hearing loss, sometimes, you know, like ear problems or flying and stuff like that. For me, it never went away. And I also had it really bad, and continue to, you know, it's never changed to this day. So the first year and a half for me, was brutal. It was absolutely horrible. And being surrounded by ambient noise in New York City made the days bearable. Mm-hmm. But when that noise drops away at night and it's just you lying in the darkness and you're surrounded by noise, but it's coming from your brain, it was pretty devastating. And it destroys your ability to sleep too. And if you go online, I don't recommend doing that, by the way, because you'll read a lot of stories of doom and gloom and devastation and people contemplating all sorts of really horrible things.
Right.
And the medical profession basically says, we don't know.
Mm-hmm.
From what I understand, it's actually the number one disability cost in the military, because one of the potential causes is hearing loss from just loud noises and explosions. So a lot of soldiers come back with it and it becomes massively disabling. Because we don't know if I got it as a side effect of having taken a medication to help me sleep while I was doing a lot of traveling. I won't take anything to help me sleep. So that wasn't an option for me. So it took about a year and a half of coming to a really dark, challenging place while I was trying to keep a happy face on the outside and simultaneously trying to meet a deadline for my last book. I literally, like, I was a couple of weeks, I remember this for the last book, Uncertainty. I'm literally writing a book about uncertainty when I'm going through this whole process. There was a time where I was coming up on the deadline for the manuscript and I hadn't told my agent or my editor anything that was going on. And I was like, all right, I don't think I'm going to hit my deadline because I'm having so much trouble having the ability to focus to even write. And so eventually I was like, all right, I have to tell them what's going on. So I sent my editor and my agent an email, which kind of brought them up to speed. And I think it was my editor who then like replied immediately. She's like, so you're telling me you just need another month? and she was kidding. She's like, yeah, you know, like, of course. She's like, you know, like, let's get on the phone right now so I can understand what's really going on with you. But of course, but I couldn't function. And I was struggling very mightily and not showing it to anyone in the world except for my wife and my family. I didn't even talk to most of my friends about it because simply talking about it was so upsetting to me because of the possibility, the thought that this was me for life, that if I talked about it, it would become real. And I didn't want it to become real. I still had hope that maybe one day it would go away. But all I could think about all day long was stop hearing the sound. Wow. And so eventually, I tried almost every intervention that you could, every alternative medicine thing. And it came to a point where I was researching for my book a lot of mindfulness and how people, how the practice can really help with uncertainty and with letting go of the stories that you keep telling yourself. It's a practice of dropping over and over and over. And I also learned that the practice has been really highly effective at helping people who experience chronic pain. It doesn't change the pain. It doesn't change the stimulus. But what it does is it trains your brain to keep dropping the signal and telling a different story. Because what you realize about both pain and tinnitus is it's actually not the, at least with tinnitus, it's not the sound that causes so much problem. It's your brain saying that this is horrendous, it's horrible, there's this high alert state, and your life is going to be a disaster. And it creates an anxiety cycle that's absolutely debilitating. So if you can train your brain to say, actually, the sound does nothing bad to my life. I'm still fine. I can still function. I can operate. There's nothing wrong with me other than this. And let yourself start to just keep dropping it and coming back to other things. You realize that's sort of like the first step. So I found a mindfulness-based cognitive therapist who was a former rock drummer who also had tinnitus and had used the practice with himself to help get much more okay with it. And it turns out he lived 3 blocks away from me on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. And I went and saw him, and I was like, could this work? And he said, maybe, maybe not, but you know, we can try it. So he told me what the practice was, and I sat and I did it, and it took months. And it was brutal because all this thing, all of a sudden, the thing I'd spent years at that point trying desperately not to experience, the initial instruction was at this point, you know, the instruction for mindfulness is basically allow your mind to just kind of keep coming back to your breath really gently. And as other thoughts and stuff come into your mind, that's fine, but just sort of let them go. You can literally label them thinking and let them go with your breath and come back to it. But if something keeps presenting itself over and over and over, at least for the moment, make that the focus of your meditation or of your attention. So the thing for me was the sound in my head. And that meant that in the early days, at least, the thing I had to make the focus of all of my attention was this thing that I was desperate not to hear. And that was brutal. And that's why, in fact, I developed a breathing practice, which is a special type of yogic breathing that allows you to sort of to lower the sort of nervous system response, the fight, flight, or freeze response, to a point where I was even capable of sitting. And I continue to do that to this day. And what I found was that there was a moment over a period of months where all of a sudden I realized one day that my mind had drifted from the sound. And that was the moment where I knew I was going to be okay, because I realized that I actually couldn't hold my focus on it anymore. And that was the window. That was like the light just kind of cracking through the window. And that very practice is something that I came to very much on my knees. And that practice has also brought me from a really dark place, first to baseline, and then become something which has opened up such possibility and such connection and such presence in everything else that I do, that it's taken a while to see it as this, but this thing, I sort of view, that I viewed first as my tormentor, has really become my teacher.
Wow.
Sorry, that was a really long-winded
answer.
No,
that was fantastic. There's so much gold in there. So I actually want to finish with two questions. One is one that I'm going to steal from you, because I want to hear your response to this, having been the person who's asked it to so many people. How would you summarize the idea of what it means to live a good life, having written a book about it and having asked hundreds of people that question?
Yeah, so I'll give you a couple of different answers. One is that one of the things I've learned is it's not universal for each person. It's very individual, but there are some really big themes there, and the two ways that I look at this are, it's when your connection, your contribution, and your vitality bucket runneth over. But on a more personal level, for me, I look to be engaged in activities and relationships that fill me up, surrounded by people I cannot get enough of, in something, and in service of something bigger than me. And when I find that that's the metric that I use to make a lot of my decisions, those buckets all fill, and that life becomes pretty good.
Hmm. All right. So I have one last question, which I know you've probably heard me ask. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
I think it's the ability to close the gap between who you are on the deepest level of self and who you bring to the world. Some people might call that authenticity. I don't understand what that word really means these days. It's become so watered down. So to me, I think of it more visually. It's, you know, it's having a really deep understanding of who you are and what matters to you and what's important and how you need to express yourself in the world to feel whole. And then living as that person with every fiber of your being in every interaction that you have with the world around you.
Hmm. Well, this has been just amazing and inspiring, as I expect it would be. Where can people learn more about you and learn more about the book?
Thanks. Well, first, thank you so much for having me on. It's always so much fun jamming with you. And they can learn more about me at goodlifeproject.com. And the book is pretty much available all over, or the page for it on the website is just goodlifeproject.com/book.
Awesome. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that. Next time on The Unmistakable Creative.
As some people can probably imagine, if you lived on boats in the 80s in the Florida Keys, when I say the Miami Vice time, if for those of you who watched that show, it was really pretty accurate. It was a bunch of people that were basically smuggling marijuana at the time. It was almost like a Johnny Depp, Jimmy Buffett sort of just happy-go-lucky time of people just smuggling, nothing negative, just not wanting to pay taxes, wanting to stay off the grid, doing their own thing. And when I say parents, that was my mother, not my father. My birth father is somewhere else in the story. So that's what they were doing. And of course, you don't realize that when you're a young kid growing up, but then you start realizing, whoa, wait a minute, what we're doing is completely different. And then I had to grow up avoiding the police, learning not to be able to talk about what I did. So it drastically affected me as a young kid because I couldn't talk about how I was being raised or how we made money.
Dean Kosegi joins us to talk about the profound impacts of growing up off the grid.